Hashem promised Avram that Avram would be the father of a great nation, and Avram Avinu recognized that as his life mission. He did everything in his power to bring that about, and at a certain point it became clear that something was being ma'akev, something was blocking. Finally, Hashem said, you will not be able to have that child here. You have to leave Haran, you have to leave your birthplace, and Avram Avinu and Sarai go to Eretz Canaan. But even there, still something's blocking. He's not having that child. His destiny, his mission in life is not being fulfilled. And it's year after year. At a certain point, Hashem appears to him and again promises him that your children will be as multiplied as the sand. You will be the father of a great nation, the Bris Ben Hamesarim. And it was obvious and it was clear that Avram Avinu was not the problem. And after 10 years in living in Eretz Canaan, Sarah Imenu recognized that she was the obstacle. It was because of her that they were not having children. At which point Sarai says to Avram, Hine na'atzroni Hashem miledes, Hashem has prevented me from having a child. Bona el shivchasi, take my maidservant. Take Hagar, take her as your wife. Ulai ibana mimena, maybe I will build through her. Recognizing the fact that for some reason she was lacking, Sarai Imenu realized there was some madrega, something she was lacking. She said, I can't do it. Take my maidservant, take Hagar, and I'll build through Hagar. The Sforna is bothered by an obvious problem with this. And that is that if Hagar has a child, Hagar will build the Jewish nation. But Sarai Imenu won't. Sarah said to Hagar, Ulai ibana mimena. Sarah said, I will build through her. The Sforna is bothered by, what do you mean I will build through her? Hagar will be the builder, not Sarah. Explains the Sforna what Sarai Imenu was doing was actually a very complex and very sophisticated thing. She said to Avram, take my maidservant Hagar. From her you will have a child. And then I will be jealous. Ulai hakina, maybe the jealousy to ora koach lepulosov, maybe the jealousy will awaken from the potential to the actual. Meaning to say, Sarai Imenu realized that there was something that she hadn't yet reached. Maybe she hadn't dominated enough, maybe she hadn't reached the highest level of Amunah, maybe she hadn't totally eradicated the Avodah Zarah, the idol worship that her descendants had been involved in. She realized that there was more that she had to attain. She had to reach a higher level. She said to Avram, take this woman, you'll have a child from her, and I'll be jealous. That jealousy will push me, that jealousy will prod me on to the higher level. I need more firepower. I need something to really give me a push. Take her, I'll be jealous, and that will make the difference. And this Sforno is quite difficult to understand. Why? Because it's hard to imagine a more motivated woman than Sarai Imenu. Let's focus on what Avram Avinu says. When after decades of not having a child, Hashem promises him great reward. Sarcha harbi mo, you'll have tremendous reward. Says Avram to Hashem, what does all this mean to me? Matitainli, what are you going to give me? It's meaningless to me. Vanochi holech ariri, I don't have children. Meaning Avram Avinu recognized his mission in life, his destiny was to be the father of the Jewish nation. And anything that Hashem promised him meant nothing to him. Why? Because that which I was put on this earth to do, my life's accomplishment, I haven't done. If Avram Avinu felt that, could you imagine how much more Sarai felt that? A woman by nature has a maternal instinct. A woman by nature wants to have children. And Sarah recognized that her role was to be the matriarch, the mother of Yitzhak, the mother of Jewish people. And she hadn't reached that. And she understood now that she was the problem. Could you imagine a woman more motivated, more driven? Whatever I need to accomplish, let me do. Why does she need this trick? Avram, take Hagar. You'll have a child from her. I'll be jealous, and that'll motivate me. I have to believe that this woman was as motivated as you can imagine, as motivated as anyone could be. Why did she need this ploy? But even more concerning, isn't jealousy a bad midah? It's a bad character trait. Jealousy is something we try to avoid. Jealousy is something that brings a person to negative behaviors, negative thoughts. Why would Sarimenu use such a dangerous and such a bad character trait as jealousy to try to accomplish whatever she used to accomplish? So I believe the two problems with this Sforno is, number one, it doesn't sound like Sarimenu needed more motivation. It sounded like she was as motivated as you could be. Number two, jealousy does not sound appropriate to use. And to understand the answer to this, what we need to focus on is a little bit of the social pressures and the social forces that exist in the world that we're not always attuned to. And let me make my point as follows. The Bali Musa explained to us that covet, honor, social position is one of the most powerful driving forces in the world, and they tell us that it affects our behaviors probably more than anything. The drive for covet, for honor, position, is such a force that it drives everything that mankind is involved in. Now, let's ask the obvious question. There is the occasional Balgaiva, arrogant buffoon who builds himself up into a pompous whatever, but that's not you and me. Meaning to say, if the Rishonim tell us this, the Bali Musa tell us this, over and over the Gemara explains to us the danger of covet, we don't see it in our world. We're not covet seekers. By and large, most of our friends aren't either. Again, you'll see the occasional person who has to have his name up in limelight to have the center billing. But the vast majority of people that we deal with on a regular basis aren't covet seekers. So what does it mean that covet is a center factor in all human behaviors? What do they mean by that? And to understand what in fact that does mean, I think we have to understand that there are three conditions, three stipulations that affect covet. Number one, covet is based on your currency. Let me explain to you what I mean. My daughter, one of my daughters, teaches 8th grade Novi in one of the Beis Yaakovs, and she's a very popular teacher, and she one day asked the girls to write down on a piece of paper what their nishonos are. What are your tests? What are the real difficult challenges that you deal with? And again, because she was well-liked by the girls, she knew that she would get real answers, truthful answers. She said to me that almost every one of the girls wrote as follows. Our big nishonos, our big tests, are Lashon Hara and Sneas. Now, Lashon Hara, I understand. These are 8th grade girls. Girls tend to be chatty, and I understand why Lashon Hara, not speaking Lashon Hara, would be a big nisayon because they talk a lot, and, you know, it's natural, so I understand Lashon Hara. But what do you mean sneeth? These are little girls. These are 12, 13-year-old girls. What, do they have some temptation to throw off all their clothing and run around naked? What do you mean that the big nisayon, the big test for an 8th grade girl is to be tsenua, sneeth? Why is that a test? So I'd like to share with you why I believe it's a test. Daniel Goleman, in his book, Emotional Intelligence, writes that there's something that he calls social awareness. Social awareness is the knowledge of who's friends with who, how good their relationships are. He explains that some people are very socially aware, some people aren't, but there are great differences between individuals' social awareness. As an example, he says, if you go into a first grade class and ask the children in the class, tell me, in your class, who is best friends with who? Some kids who are very socially aware will be able to tell you each child, this one with that one, that one with that one, that one with that one. Some kids will know some of their friends in their close circle, and some kids are clueless. They just won't be able to tell you at all who's friends with who. And he explains that this capacity called social awareness has great repercussions, and different people have different levels of social awareness. But invariably, girls tend to be far more socially aware than boys. Invariably, if you ask girls who's best friends with whom in the class, they'll have a higher rating. They'll more likely be aware of who's friends with whom than will boys. Now, isn't it interesting? Why is it that girls are much more socially aware? Are they much smarter? I don't know. It's actually based on something much more deeply rooted. The reason why girls will be able to tell you right away who's friends with who is because in a girl's world, friendships are very important. Little girls especially, and even as women become older, rate themselves based on their friendships. Friendships are very important to them. Friendships are the way they get a great amount of satisfaction. They crave friendships. They need it. And they're extremely aware of these relationships because in their world, it's a very big deal. Boys generally don't have that same need, generally, therefore, aren't as aware. And the reason why girls are far more socially aware than our boys is because in a girl's world, it's much more important who's friends with whom, how many friends they have, because again, to a girl, how many good friends she has is almost like a feather in a cap, almost a way of measuring how she's doing. But there's one more step. To little girls, as well as older women, how they look is very important to them. The reason for this is because this is one of the forces that Hashem put into a woman, a need, an internal need to be pretty, to be perceived as attractive. It serves a very real role in a marriage. But the point is that even little girls have a very real need to be seen as pretty, to be viewed as attractive. And interestingly enough, in their social world, how pretty they are, how attractive they are, is a huge part of how popular they're perceived as, how many friends they have. And if you'd like to understand what these little girls meant, these eighth graders, by saying that they have a problem with sneezes, I said to my daughter, your talmidos do not have any problem with sneezes. It has nothing to do with sneezes. Their problem is kavod. You see, in their world, their currency is friendships. But in their world, friends and how popular you are is largely based on how you look, how you appear. And in our day and age, the fashion, those who are in charge of fashion, determine that women should dress in a very unseeming, very compromising manner. And there's huge social forces, huge social pressure on these girls to conform. Why? Because they want to look attractive, they want to look pretty, they're only part of the group. They're only accepted within the group if they look pretty and look attractive. So there are huge social forces that demand of them compliance to dress according to the ways of Paris and whatever fashion gods that are out there. And these girls have no problem whatsoever with sneers. Not a one of them have a desire to throw off their clothing. They have a desire with covered. The whole class won't look at me the right way. I won't be as popular. I won't have my social standing. And it's very important to understand that this is a force. It's a force, but the force is based on one thing. The force is based on what your currency is and what's important to you, and it affects greatly what you're going to feel, and it's going to affect greatly your behaviors. And that's the first step that we have to understand, that all of COVID is based on this single factor, what your currency is. For instance, eighth grade boys don't really care anywhere near as much about clothing. And if you tell the average eighth grade boy, wear this or that, it really doesn't matter. But they sure care about other things. Let me give you an example right from here. This very same daughter became a kala. And she came home and she said to me, Abba, do you know, I don't know if you know this, but Abba, do you know that guys rate themselves based on how athletic they are? And she went on to explain. She had met somebody who said, who are you engaged to? And she said the name of the fellow. Oh, so-and-so, what a mensch, and a ben Torah. Oh, very chashuv guy. And you know, he's a great ball player. And my daughter came back to me and said, Abba, do you know that to guys, how athletic they are is important? It's like how they rate themselves. They rate themselves based on how athletic they are. But she didn't know that, was unaware of that. Because you see, to the eighth grade girls, how good they are at Machanayim or at belts doesn't really matter. And it's certainly not their social stature that's going to be determined by how athletic they are. But to eighth grade boys, it sure matters. And how well you do on the baseball field or the basketball field determines your social position. And because boys very much value athleticism and sports, and because in their world, that's what determines their social stature, They're extremely competitive and very driven. You ever notice boys will have major fights over the smallest little, the ball was fair, was full, was out of bounds. Why do they fight about it? Do they really care? The answer is what they really care about is their social position, their social stature. It's something called covet. And once you understand what a person values, you'll understand and you'll be able to see how much covet affects what he'll do, how he does, and his decisions. And the first rule of understanding covet is you have to understand that it's based on the individual's currency. What I consider valuable, what I consider important. To girls, it's pretty and how they dress. To boys, it's athleticism. But once you find the area that they consider important, then you're able to see how covet affects. But there's a second condition. To understand how covet actually functions, you have to understand the second condition is that covet is based on class. Let me explain what I mean. Let's take that eighth grade boy. Basketball in his world is very important. Let's imagine we have a boy who is the best basketball player in the entire school. Out of four classes, he is the single greatest ball player, and everyone looks up to, oh my goodness, you know, he's the best. He's the champion. No one like him. And he walks around the halls with a great pride and a sense of satisfaction. Look who I am. And in fact, his social stature is very high up there because in their world, his currency is basketball. But let's ask this eighth grader a very interesting question. Tell me, fellow, you like to play basketball? Very much so. Are you good? Oh, I'm great. Tell me, let's say you were playing in an NBA game, right? Let's say you got to get a chance to get on the court in a professional basketball game. How do you think you would do? Well, needless to say, he wouldn't be too good at all. As a matter of fact, if you put him on a college basketball game, he wouldn't even be able to hold his head up. If you put him in a high school game. So here's the question. How could you have this sense of stature and sense of importance because you're such a great basketball player when in the objective standard, you're nothing? You're not a pro. You're not a college ball player. You're not a high school. You're an eighth grade kid. The answer is that covet, my social stature, is based on my class, my peer group. Whatever I create, whatever effectively is my group, is the determinant of my social stature. You see, I'm not compared to the NBA ball players. I'm not compared to the college ball players. I'm compared to the kids in my class, in my group. And in my group, I'm number one. And this is the second rule of covet. The covet is not based on an objective standard, how much honor I have, but how much honor I have within whatever my group is, large or small. My group is what determines my stature. And even if objectively I'm not very important, but in my group I am, that's a driving force. But there's one more rule we have to understand about covet to really understand how things function. And this rule isn't as obvious, isn't as simple. So we have to sort of jump away a little bit to fully understand it. And to do that, let's make the following observation. The Mesillas Yesharim explains to us that kinah and covet, jealousy and pursuit of honor, are sisters. They're very, very similar midos, very, very similar character traits. So let's study jealousy a little bit, and I think when we do that, we'll get a much better understanding of covet. So to do that, I want you to imagine the following. I want you to imagine that you're in your driveway, and all of a sudden, you see your next-door neighbor pulls up in an emerald green Jaguar. Oh, my goodness. That's gorgeous. Emerald green. I love the color. A Jaguar. I've always dreamt of owning such a car. Wow, that car is gorgeous. I wish I could have one just like that. Here's the question. Is that jealousy? And I'd like to share with you, probably not. You see, I love the car. The car's gorgeous, and the color's amazing. I love it, and I'm very happy that you have it. I just want one like it. You should have 10 of them. You could have 100 of them. I just love it so much. I've always wanted it. I want one just like it. That's not jealousy. It's not lo sachmud, probably not even lo sesave. I'm very happy that you have it. I want one like it. But let's paint the picture a little bit differently. Let's assume that I didn't even know what a Jaguar was. And let's assume that I didn't even know that any car comes in emerald green. And I don't really care about cars or the color. But you drive up in your Jaguar, and I say the following. Oh, my God. He's driving a Jag. I want that car. I want an emerald green Jag because I want it. That is jealousy. Why? Because I don't really want the car. It's just that if you have it and I don't, then I'm jealous. You see, jealousy is never about the object. It's not that you have this object and I want that object. It's that if you have this object, you've now stepped above me. And who are you to be above me? Who are you to have that and I shouldn't? What makes you better than me that you should have that and I shouldn't have that? Who made you superior to me? And you see, jealousy is never about the object. It's about the relationship. It's about competition. Because we are competitors for social stature, if you have something, whether it be the corner office, whether it be more money, whether it be whatever, I'm jealous of you because you have that object, lifts you above me, makes you superior, and I cannot tolerate that. Jealousy is never about the object. It's always about the relationship. And the minute that you step above me, I have a lot of problems. And this is a major point that a lot of people don't realize. You see, covered comes in two distinct flavors. One is very obvious. I need to be the best. I need to have my name up on the headlines. I need to be. That's pretty clear, and it's pretty obvious. That's a standard Balgaiva, standard cover seeker. Most of us, most of the time, aren't that plagued by that flavor of covered seeking. But there's another one that bothers us all the time. You see, I don't have to have the nicest house on the block, but it can't be that everyone else is in a house and I'm still in an apartment. It can't be that I'm lower than my peer group. It can't be that everyone else is above and I'm below. And just as jealousy really fundamentally is based on our relationship, my sense of competition, my sense that you're now above me and I can't stand that, the real test in covered, the much greater test in covered, is if I have to be lower than other people. And I can't stand that. I cannot stand it that everyone else is there and I'm below. I cannot take that. And that type of covered is far more pervasive and far more common. Again, there are definitely people, and some of us, some of the time, succumb to the desire to be number one. But almost everyone cannot stand to be lower than our peer group, lower than everyone else, and that is a far more common expression of covered. Okay, now, one more step. I get this all the time. A woman calls me up and says something to the extent of, I can't respect him. I cannot respect my husband. Why not? She explains to me that he's on the internet, on pornography sites, and I just don't get him. What's with him? He knows it's usher. He agrees it's forbidden, and he still does. Why can't he be a mensch if he knows it's usher and doesn't? Just don't do it. What's wrong? Where says Yerushalayim? How could it be that he still does it, even though he says it's wrong? I just can't respect him. And it's a problem. Obviously, pornography is a problem. Obviously, her looking at him with different eyes because of it is a problem. Until you notice that this woman wears skirts, dresses that are kind of like above the knee. Or even if they're below the knee, she wears clothing that's so tight that it's so unsneeous that it's horrific. And many a time I'm tempted to say, madam, isn't there a Shulchan Aruch? And doesn't Shulchan Aruch tell us that the skirt has to be below the knee, the elbows, the knees, the collarbone? Isn't there a Shulchan Aruch that determines how one should dress, and dresses that look like they're painted on is not within the definition? What would she answer? Come on. You have to understand. I mean, I'd be so embarrassed if people saw that I didn't know how to dress. I didn't dress like it. Yeah. So here's what's really happening. Yes, he has a major problem. There's a huge force that's pulling him, a force called Taiva, and he has to work on it. But madam, with all due respect, you're also succumbing to a force. It's called social pressure. It's called kavod. But here's the point. Kavod against Yerushalayim, forget it. Social pressure against our fear of heaven, social pressure against almost anything else will cave, and you see it time after time. The woman can be very, very frum, very, very ideological, very, very holy. But when there's a huge social pressure that's pushing her the other way, forget about it. And to show you an example of how extreme it goes, I was once dealing with a young couple. They were close to being engaged, and he had a problem. See, they were both Bali Tshuva. He was a little bit more advanced than she, and he had a problem with the way she dressed. It wasn't always, but when she would go to affairs, weddings, bar mitzvahs, etc., she would wear clothing that was very problematic, but not normally problematic. She had been brought up in a secular background, and in her circle, what the women would wear dresses that were fully cut down in the back, fully open back. And one time, I was sitting with her, and I said, you know, it's obvious that this is a problem. You know, this could be the deal breaker. He doesn't want to marry this kind of woman. He doesn't want a wife who dresses this way. So she was explaining to me that it really isn't such a problem. And I said, why not? She said, look, how many affairs would we go to during the year? 3 times, 4 times a year, meaning how many weddings, how many bar mitzvahs do we have? So 3, 4 times a year, you know, I dress that way. What's the big problem? So I said to her, okay, wait a minute. If it's only 3, 4 times a year, so what's the big problem of wearing a dress that would be considered acceptable, wearing a regular dress at Sneas? And she looked at me and she goes, what? I don't want everyone to think that I don't know how to dress. And this woman was on the verge of giving up her Bashir, giving up her husband-to-be, because I don't want everyone to think I don't know how to dress. So 3, 4 times a year with people who, I don't know if she cares about or doesn't care about, but would look down upon her. And I think this is just one example of exactly this point. When you have a huge social force called honor, called my acceptance within the circle that I consider my circle, and that pushes up against another force, let's say Yerushalayim, or let's say my husband, almost every other force falls prey, because one of the most powerful forces that are in existence is our kavod, our stature, our social position. And once you understand that, you have to understand that these are things that you have to be very aware of, and you have to learn how to use them for your success. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When I was in the Blackshear many years ago, a young man who was quite solid, very good guy, came to the shiva with tears in his eyes. Rebbe, I don't feel I'm learning Lishma. I'm learning to be the best guy in the blotch here. I'm learning to be the top guy. I'm not learning Lishma. And the shiva zatzal looked at him and said, good. No, no, Rebbe, you don't understand. I'm not learning Lishma. I'm learning because I'm learning to be the best guy in the shir. I'm not learning Lishma. The shiva zatzal said, good. No, the shiva doesn't understand. I'm not learning Lishma. I'm learning to be the best guy. The shiva zatzal said, good. And the Rishiva explained why. Says the Rishiva to this young man, the only entity that wants you to learn Lishma is the Satan. Because if you learn Lishma, you'll sleep till noon. What the Rishiva Zatzal was explaining to this young man was that there's a huge force called being number one, or whatever your social force is, and that will drive you more than anything else. If you're going to learn for the sake of Hashem, for the mitzvah, you're going to sleep late. But if you tap into this social force, if you use this thing called kavod, then it's a tremendous tool that will propel you to heights. Is it pure? 100%. Why? Because if this fellow was really into kavod, if his honor and his reputation was really all he cared about, he'd be out there in the workforce making millions of dollars and getting his name out there. Obviously, he wanted to learn Hashem's Torah. Obviously, he was a pure Jew. But he was using that thing called kavod, honor, social stature, as a leverage, as a device to propel him. And what the Rishiva Zatzal was teaching us was that it's a powerful force that you should use, because if you don't use it, you won't be a thousandth of what you could have been. You'll sleep late, you won't do anything. And you have to learn how to use kavod, how to use these forces, because they're powerful, powerful forces. And I believe that's exactly the answer to Sari Imenu. You see, Sari Imenu recognized that she was lacking in some area. And she had tried decade after decade, but nothing got her moving. She realized that she had to reach out more, maybe grow in more emunah, maybe daven more. She had to reach another level, but she needed real firepower. She needed a force that would propel her, that would take her more than anything else had up until then. She said to Avram, take this woman, hug her. You'll have a child and I'll be jealous. So what? That jealousy will drive me, will propel me to heights that I could never have reached before. Sarah Aminu was using this midah called kinah as it should be used, as a leverage, as a fulcrum to gain heights. Yes, she was motivated, but even her motivation wasn't enough. She knew that she needed more, something even more powerful. She used this thing called jealousy, called this relationship issue, this social stature issue, because she knew that it would propel her to greater heights. And in fact, she told Avram to take Hagar for that reason. And in fact, she used it as a force. And I believe that there's a tremendous lesson for us to learn from this chazal. There is something, I don't know if you've had the life experience opportunity to see an Aikido master. An Aikido master is oftentimes an older man, skinny Japanese fellow wearing a kimono, almost looks like a black skirt. And someone will come to him and attack him or try to throw him. And almost effortlessly, he just sort of flips the fellow away. He'll just sort of sidestep and the fellow goes up in the air. And another fellow will try to jump him and he'll just almost effortlessly fling him away. And the basic concept of Aikido, of Jiu-Jitsu, is using the person's force against them. You see, I never resist the force. I use your force against you. Hence, a small man can defeat a much larger opponent because a much larger opponent has much more force, but the smaller man isn't using his force against the larger man's force. He's tapping into the larger man's force, redirecting it. And when you see bodies up in the air flipping over over the heads of smaller men, you begin to realize there's something here. And to me, that's a powerful mushel to the following. If you would like to succeed in life, you have to learn how to use the powerful forces that are in existence. If you want to succeed, you have to be motivated. But we human beings sometimes are motivated, sometimes not. And the idea of reaching goals without motivation is almost impossible. And if you'd like to know one of the most powerful forces to get you to reach a goal, it's using kavod, using social stature, using honor, using these forces, which are huge, powerful forces. If you tap into them, you become like that Aikido master. You could accomplish worlds more because you're tapping into one of the most powerful forces in existence. And to do that, once you know the three principles of kavod, I think it becomes obvious and pretty clear how to do it. Let's take the first one. The first principle of kavod is that kavod is based on my currency, what I value right now. So let's imagine we have that eighth grade boy. All he cares about right now is basketball. And after all, he's tops. And he's getting great accolades. He's getting great social stature for his basketball. So he's in trouble. Why? Because all of his social stature is based on his playing ball. If he wanted to become a professional basketball player, it'd be one thing. But let's assume this fellow wants to grow. He wants to grow in learning. And then he realizes that I don't really have the drive, and maybe I don't have the best head in the world, so what am I going to do? What you say to this fellow is as follows. Okay, right now you're 13 years old, and in your world right now, all that matters is basketball. But what happens when you're 15? When you're 15 and all your friends are into learning and into growing, and you're still the basketball guy, how honored are you then? And let's go a little bit further. When you're 18, and all your friends are joining Beis Medrashes, and they're all growing and accomplishing, and you're the guy who just can't make it. And let me ask you a better question. What happens when you're 25? How many 25-year-olds do you know who play basketball more than once a month? So here's the point. Yes, right now your currency is based on basketball, but it will change. Your currency when you're 15 will be different. When you're 18, it will be different. And if you begin to understand that, you can now use that powerful force called social position, called kavod, to your advantage. If you're driven by kavod, ask yourself the question, what's going to be when I'm 15? How am I going to feel when I'm 18? How am I going to feel when I'm 25? I'm going to look back and say, what a fool I was. tap into that, and now you're using that social force, because now that's going to drive you to work hard. It's going to drive you to learn, but you're not being controlled by it. You're controlling it, using it as a force. And let's look at the second rule of COVID. Second rule of COVID is that COVID is based on my peer group. My class, eighth grader, doesn't compare himself to the NBA nor to the college ball players. And to us, that is a huge concept. You see, if you want to succeed in whatever area of life that you want to succeed in, you need to harness these powerful forces of honor, of COVID, social position, and you have to create a peer group that supports that. You have to create a peer group that demands of you, that forces you to be that which you want to be. And if your peer group is the opposite, well, guess what? You're in big trouble. Because you can know from today till tomorrow how you should be acting. You should have dreams. But if your chevra, if the people you associate with and the people you hang out with don't really feel that way, you're in a lot of trouble. And by the way, one of the things that my daughter, who teaches eighth grade Navi, understands very well is that you can give all of the musa shmuzim in the world to eighth grade girls, how sneeze is so important, such a big mitzvah, and that will not have anywhere the same effect as one simple change. Get a young, pretty seminary graduate who dresses nicely, but in a sneeze manner. Make her the teacher. Put her in front of the class, and all of a sudden, everything changes. Why? Because now included in their social stature is this young, pretty teacher. Because she's not really different. She's not like a parent. She's like one of us. But look how pretty she is. And look how tzniya she is. And all of a sudden, you change the social dynamic. And when you change the social dynamic, you change everything to a much greater extent than all of the musa classes and all of the great speeches. Because the most powerful forces are those social dynamics. And rule number two about COVID is that it's based on my peer group, my class. And if you find that you want to grow in a particular area, you have to make sure that your peer group supports that and certainly doesn't work against it. But let's look at concept number three. Concept number three is I can't be below the standard. You see, some people are driven by the need to be above, but all of us cannot stand being below the standard. There are some guys who need a large yeshiva. Let's say you have an 18-year-old, 20-year-old son, and you have to know who he is to know what kind of yeshiva he needs. Some guys thrive in a big yeshiva. The energy, the group pulls them up. And some guys are destroyed in a large yeshiva. Let's say you have a guy who's a kanaka. That's his nature. His nature is he needs to excel. He needs to know himself to be number one. Put a fellow like that in a large yeshiva, and he'll never be number one. He's not brilliant. He's not the exception. He's a smart enough guy, but he's not the Eloi. And you put him in a large yeshiva, and he'll never reach that status, and he will self-implode. He'll peter out. Put him in a small yeshiva where he could, in fact, reach that level. He could be number one, and all of a sudden you have a fellow who works hard, who's diligent, who's performing, and reaches up. You see, this understanding, you have to be wise to yourself. You have to know your nature. There are some people who are very much driven to be number one. All of us cannot stand to be below, but you have to know your nature. You have to understand how much COVID affects us, and you have to figure out how to use that as a fulcrum, as a leverage, and you have to figure out how you can tap into this powerful force, because when you do, you reach stellar heights. And if you don't, it can destroy you and you could become very much different than what you wanted to be. And again, it's something that requires understanding, something that requires focusing on, and something that requires very careful strategizing. How could I use this drive for COVID or the fact that I can't be below anyone else as a force to help me serve Hashem? And that's important. But I believe that there's an even bigger application of this concept in a way that affects all of us and is dramatic in its effect. Let me explain to you what I mean. I'd like to share with you a thought experiment. It's not so pleasant, I'll be honest with you. There's a part of it that's a little not so pleasant, but I think it's worth it because I think it has a payoff that's very, very much worth it. So here's the thought experiment. Imagine that you take a pin and you insert it into my hand. Ow! Obviously, I'd be angry at you. Why'd you do that? You hurt me. You put a pin into my hand. You hurt me. Ow! What's wrong with you? Okay. Now here comes the unpleasant part. Rachman Salon, it shouldn't happen. Let's imagine for a moment that you lose your arm. The doctor says to you, we have to take off your arm or it's the only way to save you. And it's understood, they do it, put you under anesthetic, and they cut off your arm. Okay. Now they take that arm down to pathology, and they begin dissecting it. They cut off open the skin, they cut in the veins, and they cut in various incisions. Here's the question. When they have your arm down in the pathology lab, does that hurt you? And why not? They're poking it, prodding it, peeling off the skin, ripping up. Why doesn't that hurt you? I don't understand it. A minute ago, if someone put a pin in your hand, you'd be screaming, ouch, you hurt me. Now your arm itself is being cut open. Why doesn't it hurt you? And the answer is because my arm is no longer attached to me. And I believe this is a powerful, powerful thought experiment. Because you see, the reality is that just as my arm doesn't define me, my body doesn't define me. I'm the one inside. I'm the guy who thinks. I'm the guy who remembers. I'm the person who goes through all of my thoughts and desires during my day. But as my arm, if it were cut off, wouldn't bother me because it's not me. So too, my legs aren't me, my chest isn't me, my head isn't me. I'm the guy inside. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanta in Igeres Vov says that I am the neshama. The biggest mistake we make is we identify ourselves with our body. You hurt me when you punched me. I say, you hurt me. Now, it's true that it came back to me, but I am not the body. I'm inside this body. I wear this body like a coat. And one day this body is going to be taken off and put in the ground and I will separate. But the neshama is I, and I'm the one who stands in front of Hashem at the end of my days with all of my memory, with all of my conscious thoughts, with all of my desires. But this is the point. It's not my distant cousin, not some scaled-down version of me, not like I'll be dead and my neshama, whatever that is, stands in front of Hashem. It's me. Me with all of my feelings, all of my thoughts, the same one who's standing here right now thinking, feeling, will be there. My body will be in the ground, but I will be there. And for eternity, I will be whatever I shape myself into. And if you ever can get this clearly in front of you, you'll have one of the most powerful motivating forces ever in existence. Because here's the question. What's it going to be like in the world to come? What's it going to be like in Olam Haba? Now, most of us don't get too bent out of shape about it because it doesn't matter. I'll be dead. You know, my neshama, whatever that means, my distant cousin, my alter ego, that'll be there, but I'll be dead, right? But once you understand that I won't be dead, my body will be in the ground, but I'll be there with all of my thoughts, all my desires, I'll be there the same as now, then let's ask this question, what's it like in the world to come? So let's go back through the three conditions of kavod and let's sort of ask ourselves, what's it going to be like? So right now, I value a lot of things. I value money and social stature. Maybe I'm handsome or pretty or how my house looks on my car or whatever I value. Well, guess what I value in the world to come? No houses, no money, none of the silly things that we get so trapped up in. The only thing that's valuable there is what I accomplished, how much Torah I learned, how many mitzvahs I did, how much I worked on myself, how much I was misaking myself. And you and I and everyone else is going to be there. And I'm going to look at you, and you're going to look at me, and oh my goodness, my ranking, my stature is going to be based on how much I did. Says the Mesillas Yesharim in Perek Daled, this is the most powerful motivating force because he says every intelligent person understands that the madrigas, the levels are given out in Olam Haba according to how hard you worked. Explains Mr. Sham, don't you understand? You're going to be above or below. Whatever level you're on is going to be based on one single criteria. How much energy you put in, how much effort you put into davening and learning and chesed. and who you are for eternity is set. And you're going to be amongst many people, and you're either going to tower above or be belittled, diminutive, well below, all based on one thing, how much you did. Now I have many, many things that are in my currency that I value. All of them will become buttle and irrelevant. And who I am is going to be one single criteria as the determinant. That is what I did and what I accomplished. And let's look at the second criteria of covet. Here, I could have a class, a peer group that supports me. I live amongst bums. I'm the best of the bums. Look at me. I'm great. And people often do that. They create a social framework where they look great and they're wonderful. But guess what? When my body's put in the ground and I separate, my peer group suddenly changes. My currency instantly changes and my peer group instantly changes. And now I'm out there and I see everyone, huge and powerful or diminutive and weak. And all of us are in this very, very large group. And my stature now is based on, again, that single criteria, how much I grew, how much I accomplished. But the Mesillas Yesharim explains to us that it's the third condition of kavod that should be the most motivating. He explains that when I get there, there are going to be many people who I look down upon in this world. People who are, l'yitzlach, not successful. Maybe the guy didn't know how to learn, or he wasn't put together, or she didn't know how to do whatever it may be. And I get to the world to come, and I see them as towering giants, huge, powerful people, and me compared to them am nothing. And why? For one simple reason. Each human being is judged by one criteria. This was your potential. How much of your potential did you actualize? Did you reach 80%, 60%, 40%? You're right. That guy was a leyutzlach. He couldn't learn. He couldn't daven. Barely could earn a living. But do you know what his potential was? Do you know that he reached 85% of his potential? And you, Mr. Kanaker, you were learning and davening and on the board of every yeshiva and everything wonderful. You reached 50% of your potential. And that guy that you look down upon, who is no one in this world, towers over you. And you compared to him are nothing. And for eternity, you're embarrassed by that. Explains Mesillas Yesharim that this is the most powerful force because none of us can stand being below our peer group. It's one thing, maybe I don't have to be the top, but I can't have the lowest house on the block. I can't have the worst situation. And when I see people in this world who I look down upon, who I knew I was much better, I was much more put together, I was much more of a Baal Chesed, I did much more, there was no one compared to me. And I see them in the world to come towering over me, and explains Mrs. Sharm that that is the worst pain that a human being could ever experience, and it's forever. I think what this Chazal is teaching us is a fundamental concept. Sara Imenu was very driven to be the mother of the Jewish nation, very motivated, but she knew that she needed more. She needed to harness a superpower. She needed to put rocket fuel in her tank. She needed to really get moving. She said to Avram, take Hagar. You'll have a child, and I'll be jealous. She was leveraging that force because that's one of the most powerful forces in existence. What the Rishiv Zatzal was saying to that young man is, if you're learning because you want to serve Hashem, use kavod. Say, I'm going to set this goal. I'm going to be the best guy in Shira. I'm going to finish this, and I'm going to make a public banquet about it. You're using kavod as a fulcrum, as a leverage that's holy, it's pure. Sara Imenu recognized that she needed something more. All of her drive, all of her motivation wasn't enough. She needed that extra push. That extra push was jealousy, that social stature, and that's what she understood would propel her to reach greater heights. But to understand how pervasive and how effective it is, you have to understand kavod. Kavod is based on three criteria. Number one, it's my currency, what I value. So look in your world, look what you value, and then you'll see how much kavod affects you. Whether it's how you dress, how you appear, what people say about you, what people think about you, how much money you have, or whatever it may be. Once you find your currency, and you then have your drive for kavod, and if you'll say to me, but listen, I don't have to be the top. I'm a college professor. I don't have to be the most famous one in the world. Well, just watch what happens when your peers are above you and you're below. Understanding the first rule of kavod is that it's based on my currency. The second rule of kavod is based on my class, my peer group. And oftentimes you have to change peer groups. The reason why peer pressure is so pervasive and so effective is because once you create that social group, it will drive you to do that which you never wanted to do. We had a young woman who was willing to give up her husband because 3-4 times a year they wouldn't. She'd show up, they'd think she doesn't know how to dress. What does that mean? The lack of cover, the lack of honor, that social pressure was so powerful she was going to give up everything. And you see this all the time, that women dress in a way that's inappropriate because of powerful drive for cover. And once you understand how powerful this force is, and once you see how effective it is, then you have to learn how to use it. The first rule of cover is based on your currency. The second rule of cover is it's based on your peer group. It's your small group, whatever you create as your peer group. And many times you have to change your peer group. It's not that teenagers are subject to peer pressure and adults aren't. It's that teenagers are in extremely defined peer groups. Their class is their world. As adults, we can create our own peer group. And we're also hugely affected by peer pressure. We don't realize that we are because we assume that we've chosen our friends and we assume that we're Bali Bahira, we could have free choice. But once you pay attention to how much within my peer group my stature affects me, how much others looking upon me changes the way I act. And if you don't fully understand it, you have to understand the third rule of kavod, and that is that some of us, some of the time, have the drive to be number one, but all of us, all of the time, cannot stand to be lower than the rest of the peer group. And if all of your friends are making vice president or corner office or whatever that position is, and you're left out in the cold, it's one of the most hurtful things, and it's a pain that you can't get out of your heart. And explains to Mrs. Sharm, once you understand that, then take the next step. See how much COVID affects you, then ask yourself one thing. What am I going to be like in the world to come? What's my position? How much am I working? How much am I focused? How much am I driving myself to grow and accomplish more? And when you understand that who I am for eternity is based on what I make myself into, and who I am forever is going to be based on how much of me I reached, and you understand that I'm going to be amongst many, many people, and it's not going to be a value system of money or pretty or attractive or whatever else we consider here, one single currency, one group, and the currency is how much you grew, how much you accomplished, how much of you became. May Hashem grant us the wisdom and the ability to use these tools and to use these as powerful forces to grow.